Good morning. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And Joe Biden is credited with helping to write the original Violence Against Women Act as a senator from Delaware. It became law in 1994 and has been reauthorized three times since then, most recently in 2013. But in 2018, the Violence Against Women Act was not renewed by Congress and allowed to expire. Last week, President Biden reauthorized the legislation with a few new additions and a bit of bipartisan support.
No one, regardless of gender, sexual orientation, should experience abuse, period. And if they do, they should have the services and support they need to get through it. And we're not going to rest.
So what questions do you have about the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. Always email available to you, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest this morning, Ian Henderson, is the Director of Policy and Systems of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us this morning, Terry Poor, who is the policy director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. Terry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Terry, I'll start with you. From your perspective, tell us what the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act means.
Yeah, it's so exciting, the progress that you mentioned in the opening. Just last week, the president signed the Violence Against Women Act into law, and it's about a 600-page bill with some really important provisions related to services and prevention of sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, and dating violence. There's some really new and exciting policy pieces, but there's also reauthorizations of the programs that, you know, we know that rape crisis centers and domestic violence programs in Wisconsin count on for the daily work that they do. And it was really a great example of how Congress can work together in a bipartisan way to move forward major legislation. So we're really excited about it.
And Ian, tell us about, you know, what it was like in the lapse without the Violence Against Women Act. What did that mean?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to know, and Terry talked about why reauthorization is so important. I mean, the funding that was appropriated continued. So it didn't mean, even though we didn't have a reauthorized Violence Against Women Act, it didn't mean that funding went away. But I think it's the reauthorization is important. And I know we'll talk more about some of the key policy initiatives that it contains, but it also is a signal, I think, to the country and to folks in Wisconsin that, right, the Congress and the president take this issue seriously and so committed to getting this important legislation passed and signed into law.
And as the president signed it last week, he said that the violence, when the Violence Against Women Act first passed, it did more than change the law. He said it changed the culture. And so I'd ask you first, Terry, has the culture around violence against women and sexual violence changed in the last 20 years?
I think it absolutely has. Look, we still have a ways to go, but I think we're talking about the problem of sexual assault in ways we didn't 20 years ago. Having done this work as an advocate for going on 30 years now, I just remember often having an experience of like sitting in an airplane or traveling somewhere and saying, talking about what I did. And it felt like people couldn't really talk about this issue at all at that point. But now I think it's really part of our national discourse. How do we solve this problem? And I think that, you know, we've seen some major changes in institutions and people really trying to figure out how do we prevent sexual violence, because we do believe prevention is possible. And what we know about culture change is that it's so important for our leaders to talk about these issues and embrace the change. So the fact that President Biden is, you know, from the highest position in our country, really talking about the importance of this, that in itself makes a difference.
So what's new in the Violence Against Women Act, Terry Poor?
Yeah, so a lot of exciting new policy provisions. One of the major ones is a reaffirmation of tribal sovereignty to prosecute non-Indian offenders of sexual assault, child abuse, and trafficking on tribal lands. And, you know, so we know that that this is so important because the rates of sexual violence against Indian women are so vast. And before this was passed into law, it's going to take a while for it to be implemented. But, you know, tribes weren't able, if there was a sexual assault that occurred on tribal lands, the tribe, and it was by a non-Indian offender, which happens with some frequency, then they wouldn't really be allowed to prosecute that case. So we just feel like in terms of accountability, this is a tremendous step forward.
And let me ask Ian here, who works with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, this tribal sovereignty, what does this mean for your work here in Wisconsin, Ian?
Yeah, and I, you know, it's really significant. And I think, I know you had my colleague, who I'm really fortunate enough to work with, Justine Rufus, who's my colleague at Wakasa. She's also, I think she was on this program recently, also was the co-chair of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. And so when I just, you know, talked to her a little bit about this, I think she echoed and probably shared with your listeners, right, that this is a huge first step and undoubtedly a big win in expanding tribal sovereignty. And Terry talked about the rates. I mean, Indigenous women experience some of the highest rates of sexual violence, 3.5 times higher than other races. And as Terry talked about, many times, unlike other demographics, right, the people who are causing harm are non-Native. And so the ability for tribes to hold non-Native offenders accountable is really important. And I think, however, much work is still yet to be done. And I think that ties in nicely to the work in Wisconsin of the Department of Justice Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, which has been meeting now for a little over a year, and will be developing additional recommendations to address that problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women, which is not limited to Wisconsin for sure, nationally. And you look in Canada, they've also addressed that. So I think more work yet to be done, and we'll be looking to groups like the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, which are Indigenous led, which is really important, to propose additional recommendations to address that problem.
It's Ian Henderson. He's the Director of Policy and Systems of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Also joining us this morning, Terry Poore, who is the Policy Director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Is there a program or initiative that you know about that's reduced violence against women? And what can Wisconsin do better to eliminate gender-based violence? Be interested in your thoughts this morning, 1-800-642-1234. And Terry Poore, what is not in the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization?
Yeah, I mean, you know that in order to move bipartisan legislation through the United States Senate in a regular or sort of way, you need to get to a 60 senators voting to support it threshold. And so in order to do that, there was a lot of negotiation that happened by our very wonderful sponsors over the course of, you know, a number of years, actually. And one of the provisions that was really important to the advocates that didn't make it in the final negotiation was the provision that people referred to as closing the boyfriend loophole. And that would have prevented in federal law those who were convicted of domestic violence they could be prevented from having a firearm. And that it's called closing the boyfriend loophole because currently in federal law, if you are married, then the provision already exists to be able for a judge to be able to say someone can't have their firearms. But however, there's this loophole where if the partners are not married, the federal law currently doesn't cover that. But that was, you know, there were groups that opposed that provision. And as we were getting close to moving this forward, I mean, it just became clear that we wouldn't be able to get to the 60 vote threshold to get this through with that provision in there. But it did give us a lot of opportunity to talk about the importance of addressing domestic violence homicide. There are some great groups out there who are really focused on this issue. And so hopefully in the future, you know, we'll be able to do more.
Ian Henderson, are people in Wisconsin right now with domestic violence charges allowed to possess firearms? Do you know?
Yes, they are. I mean, the short answer is Wisconsin does not have a laws that would prevent or allow a judge to, as Terry just talked about, remove firearms for someone who's convicted of a domestic violence charge. What we do have, though, are firearm surrender provisions attached to domestic abuse injunctions, right? So if someone A victim petitions the court for a restraining order. In Wisconsin, they're called injunctions. The court, there are mechanisms for the petitioner to ask the court to have the respondent, in this case the abuser, surrender their firearms.
Ian Henderson, the Director of Policy and Systems of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Terry Poor, Policy Director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. As we look at the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act and take your calls and questions at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the reauthorization and what's in it and what that means for Wisconsin? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So the so-called boyfriend loophole remains part of the Violence Against Women Act as it was reauthorized last week. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and that was part of the compromise needed for the bipartisan support it took to get this legislation back on the books. What do you want to know about the details, the years-long process of getting this law back, and how this legislation may help to reduce sexual violence in Wisconsin? Police officers this morning, have you seen an increase in domestic violence since the pandemic, and how does your department respond? Are you trained in trauma-informed care? It's worth asking and would appreciate any response at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest this morning, Ian Henderson, Director of Policy and Systems of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and Terry Poor, Policy Director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. And Terry, about the police and their role in this, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act strengthens training for those in law enforcement and in the judicial system. What would this trauma-informed care look like for law enforcement and others that interact with survivors?
Yeah, we just know it's so important to have a real understanding of trauma when we're looking at a criminal justice response to the issue of sexual assault, you know, because I think historically we've seen very low rates of arrest and prosecution. And I think that's to a large extent because people expect a survivor to act in a certain way. And that's not always the case. We know that trauma impacts people certain ways, how they remember things, how they might approach or not approach facts and details. And so it's so important for law enforcement to understand that. But also we're really excited about new provisions in the Violence Against Women Act that provide some pilot projects with regard to restorative practices, because we know that while some survivors very much want to move forward through the criminal justice system, other survivors want non-criminal justice responses. So we think it's really important that survivors have a wide range of supportive options.
And Ian, in your work with Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, what role does law enforcement play?
Well, and I think, right, we've been fortunate enough to partner with the Wisconsin Department of Justice on their investigating sexual violence cases, training with officers. And so, for example, right, you know, we come in and help them as they're really doing, they do intent. I mean, their training is certainly based on an understanding of trauma, right? It's really, as Terry talked about, understanding the impacts of trauma on the human brain and how that impacts someone's ability to recall. And so that really helps officers guide their investigations, right? In terms of their first interaction with the survivor and then maybe waiting, for example, 24 hours before doing that comprehensive investigative interview. It also shapes the type of questions law enforcement officers ask, you know, asking sensory details for survivors. All of those things are really based on a trauma-informed response to sexual violence. And as Terry mentioned, right, for those survivors who do choose to engage with the criminal legal system, having a response that is geared in an understanding of trauma and then tries to adapt its response to making the experience and for survivors, as we say, trauma-informed, which is really just another way of saying, like, understanding the impacts of trauma on the human brain and designing a response that's much more victim-centered and can offer them choices and options in terms of engaging with the system.
I want to follow up here about Wisconsin, Ian, because last year, half of Wisconsin rape crisis centers reported a decrease in their funding, while at the same time, 75% of programs reported an increase in demand, and that's from the Rape Crisis Center survey. So what services from rape crisis centers are being shorthanded to make up for that imbalance?
Yeah, and I think what we've learned from that survey, and again, we're really grateful for our partnership with the Alliance, who sends out that survey. We were fortunate enough to really get a good response from Wisconsin programs. I think what we learned from that is a lot of that reduction in funding came from local and private funding sources. And so with that increased demand, right, what that meant for programs and therefore meant for survivors was waiting lists for particularly counseling services and support groups, right? And so I think with that increased demand, programs are facing a challenge, right, in terms of meeting the needs of survivors in Wisconsin, which is why it's really important that we have the Violence Against Women reauthorization with those increased funding levels. Obviously, we still need, there's work we need to do with state level funding as well. Federal funding is a huge piece of it. But we need to also look at how sexual violence services are funded in Wisconsin as well.
Ian Henderson, the Director of Legal and System Services for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also joining us. Terry Poore, Policy Director, the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. And we invite you to join us with your questions. If you've worked in a shelter, volunteered for an organization that has helped, we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org. One of the aspects that maybe folks don't immediately consider when it comes to the issue of sexual violence and sexual assault is housing. And the Violence Against Women Act increases housing opportunities, as I understand it, for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. Terry, what do we know about the relationship between domestic abuse, sexual violence, and homelessness?
Yes. Thank you so much for that question. I mean, we know that we don't know enough, but we do know enough to say that sexual assault is both a cause and a precursor of homelessness. And so that we know that a lot of times because people have experienced sexual abuse at home or, you know, in other ways that that can lead to housing instability. But that also once people are homeless or housing unstable, that can increase their risk for sexual assault. And so beginning with the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act in 2013, there was a recognition of the need to protect the sexual assault survivors with regard to their housing and go farther. So one provision relates to survivors of sexual assault in public housing who can who have the right to request a transfer to a different unit if they were sexually assaulted in the unit or it's a very traumatic experience for them. And then in this reauthorization, we're excited that the definition of homelessness has been expanded to really look at what's the real experience for sexual assault survivors so that homelessness service providers and rape crisis centers can work together more to meet the needs of homeless sexual assault survivors. In the survey you referenced before, we know that rape crisis centers see homeless survivors as some of the most unserved survivors of sexual assault.
Ian Henderson in Wisconsin, then what protections do survivors have to keep them from being evicted from their home?
Right. Well, so I think one of the existing protections related to for survivors is a prohibition on evicting someone because they are a survivor of sexual violence or domestic abuse. There's also some additional protections that allow a survivor to terminate their lease early, right? So we know that most sexual assaults occur at or near a victim's residence. And so it stands to reason, therefore, that many survivors may want to relocate after after experiencing sexual violence. And so existing law in Wisconsin allows a survivor to terminate their lease early if they can provide to their landlord a copy of an injunction, right, or a restraining order, like we've talked about earlier, or a copy of a criminal complaint. So those are pretty good protections. I think WCASA and our partners at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin have been working and lobbying in the legislature to try and expand those protections. Because for sexual violence survivors, right, many don't report to law enforcement. And even if they do report to law enforcement, that still requires the district attorney to issue a criminal complaint. And so that avenue may be not an option for sexual violence survivors. So they would have to get a restraining order, which means, you know, confronting their perpetrator in court and convincing a court and proving a court to the court grounds for a restraining order. And so one of the things we've been working on is allowing an additional way to terminate a lease early by having a survivor submit a written statement from an advocate at, for example, one of our rape crisis centers who would say yes, attesting to their belief that the person is a victim of sexual assault. We so far haven't been successful in getting that law passed, but you know, we did have a hearing in the Assembly Committee, Housing Committee this past session. We've had bipartisan support. So I think it's something we're going to continue working on at the state level.
Still more work to be done, even with the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Ian Henderson, very much appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you doing this call today and focusing on this topic. I just want to say real quickly, in addition to my gratitude for being on the program, is it's well-timed, not only with the VAWA reauthorization, but next week is April 1st, a week from today, and that begins Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So just want to remind folks to look out on our website and look for their local program for awareness and Sexual Assault Awareness Month activities in their community.
Terry Poore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Well, it's great to be here.
Terry Poore is a policy director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. Ian Henderson, director of policy and systems of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Listen, if you're experiencing domestic violence, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233. 799-7233. We have a link to the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault on our website at wpr.org/mornings. That's wpr.org/mornings. Up next, news, then Wisconsin Life, then we enter the fray into the debate over daylight saving time. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. Hey, it's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a friendly debate between two beloved Wisconsin desserts.
We recently received an audience question through WPR's Wisconsin Project about two iconic Wisconsin pastries, the cream puff and the kringle. WPR's Tim Peterson was up to the task of getting to the bottom, or at least the delicious sugary middle, of what separates them.
Marissa Wojcik of Madison grew up in the Eau Claire area, regularly consuming Kringle at family gatherings. Her experience with cream puff, on the other hand, is limited. Just one puff. And it did not blow her away, which prompted her to ask us,
why do cream puffs get all the attention when the Kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924.
Paula Hare is Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puffs. That's the pop-up bakery from the Wisconsin Bakers Association responsible for making and serving cream puffs for that annual 11-day run.
It is certainly the most popular and longest-running food item at the State Fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights, and having your first cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. Our cream puffs are made from Wisconsin dairy rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry, and biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven.
But some people push back on our very serious Kringle versus cream puff premise.
Well, cream puffs are delightful. This is the most friendly debate ever.
Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. She also had thoughts on the cream puff.
It's that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top, and I think definitely has a place.
Now, for the official state pastry, so anointed by the legislature in 2013, here's Seaver again.
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in, and it became a sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the Kringle was an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the Kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We wanted to dig a little deeper, get under the crust of what separates these two. Seaver gives us a quick lesson, starting with the cream puff.
In terms of the technique, choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. and then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked on. And then when you're talking about Kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good Kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks. But they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
And like the cream puff, Kringle has a special yet different place in our hearts.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story about two beloved Wisconsin pastries. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, you may be wondering how it is that our United States senators could unanimously agree on anything. So, quick story. 2 days after our clock sprang ahead an hour for daylight saving time this year, the United States Senate said never again, and they did so by unanimous consent. But that doesn't mean that our august and most deliberative legislative body unanimously agreed to keep DST. Any single senator could have blocked the bill from passing, and according to BuzzFeed News, Senator Tom Cotton vehemently opposes year-round daylight saving time, but his staff never informed him of the voice vote. Senator Roger Wicker had previously voiced concerns about going to school in the dark, but his flight back to D.C. had been delayed. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who was presiding over the Senate at the time, said she was surprised not one senator objected. Her state, Arizona, doesn't change their clocks. She said, quote, because we're smart. And that is evidently how you get unanimous consent from the United States Senate. The House would have to vote on making daylight saving time permanent. The president would have to sign it into law. But is this the best way for us to keep the most of our days? Is there a better clock that we can use to keep and count our time together? 1-800-642-1234 if you've thought this through, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our next guest has. Spencer Dawson is an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University. He's also on the advisory board of the nonprofit known as Save Standard Time, which calls for an end to daylight saving time altogether. Spencer, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Are you still adjusting to the time shift from a couple weeks ago?
Truth be told, I am. It is still quite dark here in the mornings, and it's still a struggle.
So give us a little bit of history. Now, some have accused the farmers of giving us daylight saving time. It's nothing new. It's been around for decades. But how did this all begin?
It was an experiment that started around World War One, and it was tried, the idea of having permanent daylight saving time was tried a couple of times, during World War II from 42 to 45, again, very briefly in 1974 during the oil crisis that was rapidly overturned, was wildly unpopular, particularly due to late sunrises in the winter, and some fatalities of school children at dark bus stops.
So that did not stick, but as we've got daylight saving time and then standard saving time, which is what your group advocates for. What's the difference between these two systems?
So standard time is aligned with the light-dark cycle in the environment kind of as best as we can if we're trying to create groupings of 1 hour kind of for the purposes of simplistic kind of organization. So the advantage of standard time is that noon happens around noon and sunrise happens early in the morning and sunset happens earlier. Daylight saving time basically forces everybody to wake up an hour early and go to bed an hour early by shifting the clock by an hour.
Did this actually save energy when we tried the permanent daylight time? Was that an energy saver as it was intended?
That was the intention, but it actually did not pan out.
And in your work in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University, what's all this time shifting twice a year doing to us?
So it causes a number of different problems. So we might hear my department be particularly concerned about issues related to mental health, but there are also significant problems that we see in terms of physical health. We see every year with the time change, when we spring forward, we see increases in heart attacks, deaths, accidents, and so on.
So this is dangerous, what we're doing, according to the science.
Absolutely. I certainly am totally on board with the simple idea of having an hour of extra light after work, but not at the cost that it comes with.
Spencer Dawson, our guest, and the invitation to you to make your case for a permanent daylight saving time, for us to continue to change our clocks twice a year to try to accommodate the most sunshine we can grab, or as the nonprofit Save Standard Time suggests, keeping standard time year round. And Spencer Dawson, what would let me give out the phone number 1-800-642-1234 to make your case. But what would saving standard time year round look like, feel like? What would the consequences be?
Standard time year round would mean not having what we just experienced with having an hour of extra darkness in our mornings here in the spring. I want to contrast it with permanent daylight saving time, which would push back those dark winter mornings and keep those darker for an extra hour. That's kind of the biggest sort of concern that I have with this. It relates to our 24-hour circadian rhythms. All life, with only just a few exceptions on this planet, has a 24-hour circadian rhythm that organizes our activity and physiology around the local light-dark cycle. And this is kept on track by the sun, not surprisingly. That's what gives us light and darkness in our environment. Now, the problem with daylight saving time is it forces us to wake up in the biological night when our bodies are still trying to be asleep. If you've ever tried to rouse a teenager in the morning for school, that's what it feels like to try to wake up an hour earlier. This would exacerbate that by a further hour of trying to wake them up even earlier. Younger children who really just refuse to go to bed when the sun is still out in the summer at 9 p.m. or later, they're not wrong. Their bodies are 100% in tune with the light-dark cycle in the environment, but that daylight saving time in the summer forces us to set our clocks differently.
Spencer Dawson, assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University. He's also on the advisory board of the nonprofit known as Save Standard Time. And in the face of a unanimous consent voice vote in the U.S. Senate to make a daylight saving time permanent, we investigate whether or not we're keeping the best time, whether we should change it twice a year, whether keeping a standard time may fare better in where we are here in Wisconsin. And we give you the opportunity to participate and make your case at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and the case for daylight saving time, standard time, and keeping our clocks on time continues next on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. An AP poll from last October shows that most Americans want to avoid switching back and forth between daylight saving and our standard time. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and as NBC15.com points out, where I live here in Madison, if we don't switch back to standard time, we'll have 80 days where the sun doesn't rise until after 8 in the morning, from just before Thanksgiving until just before Valentine's Day. So how would you like us to be thinking about how best to set our clocks to best fit our lives? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Spencer Dawson is an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University. He's also on the advisory board of the nonprofit known as Save Standard Time. And Spencer, you're a sleep scientist, so I would imagine that plays a role, or that is the deciding factor in why you think saving standard time would be the best way for us to keep our clocks.
Yeah, I think it plays a role because I'm familiar with the health effects that come from insufficient sleep and from what we would call circadian misalignment. which is a discrepancy between your internal clock and, well, the light dark cycle in the environment.
Yeah, and just with the example of morning radio, the in the summertime, trying to go to sleep while the sun is still out can be a challenge, and just about any time trying to wake up before the sun can feel like a struggle. Does the science back that up? Is that just an anecdote from my experience, or is that the way our bodies generally respond?
No, that's 100% correct. So part of what organizes, the main thing that organizes our 24-hour body clock is a hormone called melatonin, which is secreted by the pineal gland only in darkness. And that is a timing signal that lets humans and other animals that are day active to know that it's nighttime and we can go ahead and sleep. If we are trying to go to sleep while there is still sun out, that melatonin is not going to be secreted, and we're not going to be able to fall asleep, or we're going to really struggle.
Let's go to the phones now. And I'm also curious if there are those, and I'm not pointing any fingers, who just wait for daylight savings time to be over for their clocks to be right again. 1-800-642-1234. Yeah. Katie in Janesville, you're on with Spencer Dawson. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Just a quick question. This fall, when we fall back an hour, what would happen if we just fell back a half an hour, kind of splitting the difference between the two and keep that permanent? Would that get any closer to those circadian rhythms?
Katie, that's interesting. We also had Gary call but couldn't stay on the line and suggested we turn the clocks back a half hour and leave it that way. And Gary says people would eventually forget all about the clock changing. What if we split the difference, Spencer?
Yeah, I really like that idea. It's a creative solution. It pushes for compromise and kind of working together. So I love the spirit, and I also love the idea of keeping the clock set at the exact same time. The problem is that it's kind of a half measure, and we'll still have, you know, you were mentioning earlier, 80 days in your area where sun rises after 8, it would instead be 7:30. So is it better than permanent daylight saving time? Yes, but it's not as good, and from my perspective, as permanent standard time. And from a legislative perspective, we haven't gotten into this, and we don't need to. It would be more complicated than simply going to permanent standard time.
Does daylight saving time affect people differently depending on where they live across the country?
Absolutely. So it's going to make a big difference based on how far east or west you are within your time zone. With people at the western edge of the time zone, such as myself, seeing much, it sort of exacerbates the existing sort of problem that we have. We also see big differences in terms of what the light dark cycle looks like across the year based on how far you are from the equator. So folks up in Wisconsin, you see pretty dramatic swings in terms of how long your days are in the summer and how short they are in the winter. Folks down in Florida, for example, they don't see that swing nearly as much.
Spencer Dawson, assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University, sleep scientist. He's also on the advisory board of the nonprofit known as Save Standard Time, which would put an end to daylight saving time. What questions do you have about daylight savings time and how it could affect your sleep or mental health? 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Daniel in Madison. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I want to know how the change in time affects the military, because I know the military relies heavily on time for their operations. So when we fall back and spring forward, how does that affect the military?
Interesting. Spencer?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think the military is a great example of a very large organization with a very important job that has to stay very organized. And so when you look across a large organization such as the U.S. military, something that some people might sort of brush off as a small change of just an hour has a ripple effects. It's the law of, you know, the law of large numbers, where we look across the entire military, you're going to see some pretty significant problems arise, even if it's not true for every single individual. So those problems will be multiplied out. We'll see issues with alertness, with accidents, with mental health problems, with physical health problems. And those are all things that we should be, in my opinion, supporting for everybody, but particularly those who serve in our armed forces and who we are also responsible for caring for in terms of providing health care and mental health care, both while folks are serving and after their service.
Let's continue with your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234, where Roger is standing by. Roger, you're on the air with Spencer Dawson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to make a comment that my aunt and uncle solved the problem. I saw they had two clocks in their kitchen, and they were an hour apart. And I said, what's going on with that? And they said, well, one is the town time, and one is our town time. They also had two clocks in the barn, too. Said, we can't have the cows reset their clock and tell them to get up at a different time. So when we have to go to town, which is probably about once a month, we'll know what time it is when we get to town. And in the meantime, we have our time, which never changed. The other idea that I had would be, as the lady said, maybe go incrementally. I'm older now, and I still haven't adjusted to daylight savings time. Sorry. I quit my day job when I was 68, and I'm much older than that now. And we could maybe go incrementally, like every 10 minutes, change the time like once every 2 weeks or once a week or so incrementally to ease us into this thing. Rather than slam the door with a full hour? Come on.
My car clock would be very confused, but I think of all the clocks now that are set to some sort of satellite that match up and, you know, minor shifts in time by a couple minutes a day. Would that even be noticed if we were all synced to some sort of satellite? And at the same time, farmers, you know, got it figured out with a couple of clocks to figure out whether or not they're on cow's time or the town's time. That could get kind of confusing, Spencer.
Yeah, again, I like this idea, and there are a lot of good principles in there. And I would say, I would dare say that cows in some ways are smarter than us. They are not clock. They stick on the same time. The incremental idea, that's something that I often in my practice, you know, recommend to folks as a way to sort of buffer the impact of that time change. So a lot of folks will encourage them to start making that shift in their clock a couple days before, and if they can kind of allow themselves a couple of days of a grace period on the other end of the time change, they can do their own sort of 10 minute by 10 minute sort of change and spread that out over the course of a week. It gets into the practical questions around implementation, though, of how we would actually make that work. And that would be sort of my biggest concern there with something like that, in addition to my position, which is that we should just avoid the time change entirely, which the majority of folks in this country do support.
An advisory board member of the nonprofit known as Save Standard Time, Spencer Dawson, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Spencer is also an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University. News is next. Then we get the latest on new research into COVID-19 as we try to get our head around what may be next. Has it jumped from deer back to humans? And what indicators should we be looking for to figure out what's next in this pandemic? Or are we moving to an endemic? We're going to tackle it all in the next hour. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.